Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
Welcome to episode 2 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo, joined by Thomas Neff and listeners. I hope you're ready for a loaded edition of the show because we do have a lot to cover. Am I right, Thomas, or am I wrong?
100% right. Canadian Division number 2, possibly coming up, Canadian Championship Final. The 3 MLS clubs getting ready for their seasons down in the States. It's been a couple leaks from the Canadian U23 Olympic squad. Some CPL news, Tristan Borges, yes, back with Forge, and Jonathan David and Alfonso Davies doing things in Europe as usual.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, why don't we start, Thomas, with the Canadian Championship Final, because we finally have a date for it, or so we think. I'm not really sure yet. The match was slated for March 20th. That is according to Christian Jack. However, since that news was revealed, Bob Young and Forge FC have come out pretty much criticizing Canada Soccer for what can kind of amount to favoritism and essentially helping out Toronto FC as opposed to helping out Forge. Since then, Christian Jack has actually gone on to say that Forge's preference would be playing this final sometime around April the 3rd before the winner of the Canadian Championship would have to face Leon in the CONCACAF Champions League. Now, the reason why Bob Young is apparently so incensed is because TFC began their preseason, as everybody probably knows, February 17th, whereas Forge hasn't been granted permission to train by the province of Ontario yet. So if that final is played March 20th, Forge would only get 7 to 8 sessions before that scheduled date. Now, based on Bob Young's reaction, Thomas, it sounds like that is when it's going to be played. But what do you make of this whole debacle and this back and forth going on?
Oh, it's a mess. It's a mess, 100%. Everyone knew that the Canadian Championship was going to be played because it wasn't played last year. It was rumored before around December of last year, but it obviously didn't happen. Everyone knew that it was going to happen around March or April. And obviously, TFC going down to the U.S., they don't want to stick around any longer than they have to, of course, since, you know, they would have to come back to Canada, quarantine again, and then come back to the U.S., quarantine again, and that would really mess up things with their MLS schedule. And of course, like you say, a couple months back against Lyon, it's a huge opportunity for a side like Forge. They're underdogs. I would say even massive, massive underdogs, just considering how the two starting 11s, just how much each starting 11 is worth. One is worth millions. The other is worth, I think, short of 1 or 2 mil. But yeah, TFC definitely have a much bigger budget. Yeah, I think they're getting their anger out at the wrong governing body. Although it's interesting that we haven't really heard from the Ontario Ministry of Sports. You know, she hasn't really come out and said anything about this. I think it would be the perfect time for that to happen. Or, you know, Canada Soccer to put out a press release explaining the situation. I think that would be extremely helpful.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, it's not only weird that we haven't heard from the province or anything like that. It's also very weird that the CPL hasn't come out and said anything. As you said, Canada Soccer hasn't really commented. It's Bob Young who's kind of brought this to the forefront. So it is kind of frustrating. But look, on one hand, I feel like no matter what, you're going to be putting someone in a precarious position just because of the pandemic. If you had played it in December, that's in the middle of winter in Ontario, you know, that wouldn't have been the most convenient, really. If you're playing it at this potential March 20th date, that puts Forge at a disadvantage. The interesting part of this is, if, let's say, Canada Soccer compromises and gives Forge a more favorable date to at least get into shape, give themselves a few more training sessions. The interesting part of this is you don't have to quarantine when you go to Mexico from Canada. If you obviously present a negative test within 72 hours of your flight, which obviously this would be the case for either club should they win the final. They would face Leon April 7th. So if the final was played early April, that would still be more than enough time to be able to play that game, get down to Mexico, settle in quickly, and then play that match. The only interesting part would be what would happen if Forge wins, and then obviously the second leg might have to be played in Canada, but we've seen that the federal government's been very strict with these things. Teams coming from outside of Canada to play, obviously the Blue Jays, the Raptors, the Canadian NHL teams have had problems with this, so that might be an interesting part. But I feel like the one potential roadblock towards an April final or after March 20th final would be, you have to keep in mind too that every 11 in the Canadian Championship needs to have at least three Canadians in it. And Toronto FC, you would imagine, are going to be releasing some players to the Olympic and senior teams. TFC might keep some players anyways. They have kind of indicated they might hold some players back, so it may not be an issue. So if not, schedule it later. What is the harm? But yeah, I just find it very odd that the actual governing bodies that could maybe put this issue to rest haven't really spoken about it yet.
Yeah, and let's not forget, the federal government hasn't even approved this Canadian Championship final.
Yeah.
So it's not official, it's not confirmed. If Forge appeals and then they get granted their wish or whatever, I think April wouldn't be good for either side, whoever wins, because of that time frame. And honestly, I don't see that the federal government would approve anything of that nature, in the sense that they could probably barely approve two Canadian sides playing each other. With no fans, or maybe little few media. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think they would approve something like Lyon coming down, no. Especially since they haven't granted it with the Raptors, the Jays, and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. But then you also have the added wrinkle, which I just forgot about when I was talking about moving the final to a later date. Let's say Toronto FC releases three or four or five players for those qualifiers, whether it's the Olympics or the World Cup qualifiers. Upon return, they have to quarantine. Like, that is a requirement in Canada, regardless of who you are. Now, it could be shorter than other people, but you still have to be isolated for a period of time. So if the final was played April 3rd, and let's say Canada stays all the way in Guadalajara for the entirety of that tournament, they only have 4 or 5 days from the time they leave to that final to kind of, you know, get ready, and that just wouldn't be enough time, right? And then obviously with the senior team, same kind of thing. Their last game, I think, is what, like the 23rd, 4th, something around there. So that gives them a week and a bit. Logistically, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. But this kind of goes back to my point, Thomas, that no matter what you decide with a date, you're going to be inconveniencing somebody, and that's just reality in a pandemic, unfortunately. So I guess we'll have to see what happens from here, but it is certainly interesting to see the juxtaposition that all sides are really facing. And Thomas, a potential Canadian second division in 2022, maybe even more than that. We'll get into that maybe a little bit later, but to those who missed it, Dwayne Rollins of Soccer Today at 24th Minute on Twitter revealed that there are, quote, ongoing plans to create a Canadian second division, end quote, which targeted initially a 2020 soft launch, but it was postponed due to the pandemic, as have many other projects, but I digress. Those involved in the league believe a 2022 start date is possible. You can read the details on Dwayne's site at 24thminute.substack.com, and we'll also link the story in the podcast description.
Yes, and to help us break it down for the new proposed Canadian Division 2. We have the man who broke the story, Dwayne Rollins of Soccer Today, who has kindly made time to answer questions on the subject. Dwayne, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here.
So, just to start off, can you tell us who is behind the leak?
I was asked not to reveal exact names on this, but I can tell you this, and anyone who pays attention to the Canadian soccer system can kind of read between the lines. I mean, it's primarily Western-based, the initiative, and the clubs involved are well-known to most people. One of the clubs involved, Edmonton Scottish, is publicly out with this, so I can say their name. You're looking at established clubs out there that are looking to increase their level to find a top of the pyramid for their internal systems, but not necessarily clubs that are going to be ready to fully take the jump and pay an expansion fee, which is thought to be around $10 million, to enter the Canadian Premier League. So this offers a lower entry point and the opportunity to in their minds, develop a level which is semi-professional probably to begin and increasing up to the point that it might be something that would be attractive to folks to go out and support.
Well, on that same kind of subject, Dwayne, with this all in mind, would the second division, based on who you've spoken to, what you're hearing and everything else, would it be financially sustainable to operate at, say, an optimal level in their minds?
Yeah, for sure. And really the finances, the economics of it are what attracted people to this. I can tell you that the people that I speak to have had dealings with the CanPL and have even investigated the potential of having teams in that league. So they understand what the financials are there. They understand what the realities of that league are. And they have decided that at this point in time, they feel that that's just a step too far. But they do think that there is a market there, that there is potential to grow the sport in the markets, in particular in Western Canada. So they believe so. Now I think it's important to stress that this would be a regionalized league. The analogy that most Canadians will understand is it would be similar to the Canadian Hockey League in terms of how it is organized. Mm-hmm. So you would have, you know, if you don't know the CHL, it would have, you know, the OHL, the Quebec League, and the Western Hockey League. So you only play within your league until a playoff at the end. And they would be looking at something similar to that with indeed a final tournament. You know, you can call that a Final Four status, or you could call it a Memorial Cup status if you want to keep the hockey analogy going. But yeah, they think that there are ways that they can make this sustainable for them. And the number one way of which they would do that is by keeping this regional.
Dwayne, you touched on that there. I'm guessing it has to be Canada Soccer / FIFA sanction, no?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it would be. They would be looking for full sanctioning through the CSA. They don't think that there would be any issue with that. The CSA has, for the better part of 5 or 6 years now, been trying to encourage its clubs. At first, they were trying to encourage its clubs through a stick by saying they wouldn't sanction them, encourage them to not be in American leagues. They've since backed off that a little bit, the stick, that is, without, you know, instead trying to encourage them positively to be part of Canadian solutions rather than in the American systems, which is thought to be kind of a dead end after years of trying it. You know, what's the definition of insanity? You try the same thing and expect a different result. That's Canadian soccer, right? They keep attaching themselves to American leagues, and it doesn't necessarily help the overall growth. We can argue that more on a different day, but certainly they don't anticipate that the CSA is going to have a problem with them trying to create a Canadian solution.
Okay, interesting. Well, you mentioned it in the piece, but you know, will the quality be higher than an L1O, a PLSQ, or, you know, what we're seeing now in BC? They're kind of creating their own equivalent as well. Like you mentioned, it may have a semi-pro tag to start with, maybe the aim of eventually becoming professional. So what would the quality be like if you maybe had to pin it down?
Yeah, and this is an area where I'll start by saying what they said, and then I'll editorialize a little bit. So their perspective is that this would be in between the two levels, that they feel that their top teams on a given day could potentially even beat a Canadian Premier League team. That's what they feel, that they have enough talent out there. They're basing that sort of on scrimmages they've had with Canadian Premier League teams, their understanding of that player pool, their understanding of what's out there. They feel that there's a lot of young Canadian players, particularly in that sort of 17 to 21 range, that are underutilized in the Canadian Premier League, that might feel that this is an opportunity for them to start and play regular minutes in a league like this, and that in turn would allow them to be more competitive with that than a League One Ontario or PLSQ, which is more of a development sort of setup, right? Mm-hmm. Editorializing, I think in the West, I see a real need for this, and that's because there isn't a League One Ontario or a PLSQ in the West. There is talk of a BC One starting, but in the Prairie, there's nothing. So I can't see an argument against them doing this. But you know, when we're talking about them adding teams in Central Canada, which is where the PLSQ and League One Ontario operate, obviously, I struggle to understand the distinction that they're going to find there, to be candid with you, but they believe there is. So we'll leave it at that. But for sure, that is something that would be worth keeping an eye on.
Now, you mentioned in your piece, and you mentioned it earlier, the $10 million expansion fee. Just how much will that impact future CPL expansion? You think it will limit it to only 10, 12 teams? Or you think we might not even make it there?
For sure, it is slowing expansion. I believe the league, I haven't spoken to the league directly about this, but I believe what the league would say is that it's important to make sure that those that are coming into the league have the wherewithal to stick with the league for a while, and that's part of what this expansion fee being pretty large would guarantee. They want to avoid a situation where sort of fly-by-night operators come in, like we saw, in the late 70s and the end of NASL. That's something that they want to avoid. So, but in terms of right now, there is believed to be momentum behind getting one or two teams in Quebec in the very near future, but most of the other momentum outside of Quebec has all but dried up. I can tell you, Saskatchewan, for instance, is a market that a lot of people were excited about a couple years ago. There was even some public conversations going on around that. A bit of a stadium plan came out. I can tell you that is not happening right now, that there is not a chance that you're going to see a Canadian Premier League team in Saskatchewan unless a new investor materializes it in the days ahead. So I think some of the thinking with this league is that you come in at a level that's closer to $500,000 investment. That's just a ballpark, but something much lower than what the Canadian Premier League would be. Then you have less risk up front. It allows groups to try it. And if it doesn't work, that's unfortunate, but they're not out as much at that point. And sort of they can, the risk aversion is less. So you'll get into more markets quickly. And if some of those markets thrive, so for instance, to go back to Saskatchewan, they put that stadium up in Regina that was talked about. They're suddenly getting 5,000-6,000 out, like, and we're having crowds that look like Halifax's. Then maybe at that point, those investors go, okay, yeah, that $10 million makes sense now. I want to get into the big show. That's an MLS type model where you're buying in to the top level as opposed to getting promoted up to it. That's likely going to be the model for the next few years, whether they get to something more organic, something more in line with the rest of the world down the line. Well, this Campiel's on record saying they'd like to get there, but there is a process and we're not close to the end of that process yet.
Right. I was going to follow up and ask you if promotion relegation was in the plans as an end goal, but definitely by what you're saying, doesn't seem like it's in the cards for the immediate future.
Yeah, it certainly wouldn't be something they would be launching on. There's an understanding, like this league would be different. It would be shorter. It would be have smaller expectations in terms of infrastructure. It would just generally not be at the same standards as the Canadian Premier League, which is going to require 5,000-seat stadiums. It's going to require that you have them fully lit and TV ready. It's going to require that you pay yourself a salary to all players. There's going to be travel understandings. As much as I've, written and think that there's issues around some of those standards in the Canadian Premier League, they'd still be much higher than this. That's not to say they won't be quality in this. It's not to say that there won't be expectations, but they're manageable. They're more realistic. And, the unfortunate reality is that Canadians as a whole are a little more risk adverse than our American counterparts, which we like to compare ourselves with. So this would offer to me just a level that would be more palatable to certain investment groups. Like, I think you could see mid-sized cities try this out. Your London, Ontario's, your Kitchener-Waterloo's, your to go out west, your Regina's, your Saskatoon's, places like Lethbridge, Kelowna, cities that don't necessarily have major league teams or even even professional teams of any kind right now, might feel that this is a level that they can come in on and more importantly get traction in the market. You're going to put a team like this in Toronto, and no one's going to pay attention to it, right? Bluntly, they're not. I mean, I will, but you're going to have 20 people out there. You put a team like this in my hometown, Belleville, Ontario, and you market it right, you could get 1,000 people into that, and that would be workable and that would be valuable.
Yeah, I could see that definitely working in, a KW and a London, as you mentioned, Kelowna for sure. I mean, they're very into soccer over there, and if you give any sort of a mainstream feel, people will flock to it, you would imagine, especially depending on the time of year. But I guess one of the determining factors of quality, Dwayne, is at times salary, and you kind of touched on it there. What would the salary structure be like in this D2?
Yeah, a lot of the players would be NCAA players, which would not be able to take a salary. That would make up a good portion of these rosters. The league would be set up to support those players, particularly on the women's side. We haven't talked about that. I don't know if you have a question lined up for that, but there is a women's plan as well. But on the men's side, give me that for a second. You would have the occasional Dylan Carrero is the player that was brought up to me. That Dylan Carrero might retire from Canadian Premier League, but might, you know, decide to play this level for a few more years and get a bit of a salary with it. You'd be talking like a little higher than League One Ontario stuff, which is more stipend than salary, mm-hmm. but not necessarily anything that would be, you know, going to make you rich on. But you might like $5,000-$6,000 a season for it, maybe for a couple of the players, $5,000-$6,000 per team. Again, if you want to compare that to League One Ontario, League One Ontario has the ability to pay up to four players per team and no more than $5,000 for your whole roster, whereas this would be you'd be paying four or five players, maybe even a few more, about that each. So that's kind of your range, and that's another distinction that you'd be looking at between L1O and this. I think the PLSQ pays a bit more, to be honest. I don't know the PLSQ's finances as well as I know League One Ontario's, but certainly, you know, one player might make what is allowed for an entire team in the League One Ontario. And I can tell you that in League One Ontario, there's only one or two teams that pay anyone anything. So, you know, we'd be talking about a semi-pro versus a mostly amateur league.
In the piece, you mentioned as many as 12 teams could be involved. As far as the breakdown, two regions, no? Central and West, no teams out East?
Yeah, I didn't hear anything about the Maritimes. They have travel issues, you know, as you can understand. This would be mostly a bus league. So if you're going from Halifax to Toronto, that's 15 hours. We're in the Toronto area anyway, just to use a bit of an analogy there. So that's tough. I think that there is an understanding that it would be ideal for the Maritimes to have something down the line. And I believe, just as with the CHL, that the people involved in this are very interested in regionalizing this further, so that if this was successful and it showed a model that worked, that they would absolutely be looking to expand it out there as well, but they would be looking to expand it in big numbers out there so that they could play each other. You know, so you have your Fredericton's play your Dartmouth's or Dartmouth's and play your, you know, whatever. It would be more of a Maritime situation down the line than off the top.
Well, closing out on this then, Dwayne, because you again touched on it, but there's also the potential for a women's competition that could fully launch by 2023 with maybe an earlier start date for like a pilot project. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but would that be in any way related to the talk of a women's CPL equivalent? And what can you tell us more about the women's side of things?
Everything involved in this project is entirely independent of the Canadian Premier League at the current time. That doesn't mean that they won't reach out once they're closer to launch to try and create partnerships with that. I think as it relates to the women's division, which you're right, what they suggested is just three things I want to stress. The first off, they stress that they will not launch this unless there are women's teams attached to it. They are committed internally to the idea that they must launch with women part of it in some capacity. They have also said that being the case, that there might need to be a softer launch for the women's side, as you alluded to, simply because the finances don't work at the same level and you have maybe a more difficult time recruiting to the same level. There's less of a player pool, basically. So they might have to launch it soft. What they do in that case is maybe have a shorter tournament. So they would have some teams involved in the end and declare a champion, but it might not be a full season in the first year. But they absolutely would have women's programs attached to every program in this league. That would be a requirement of it. So that's a positive thing. In terms of the potential, which is really what the second part of your question relates to, I'm editorializing now. I think there's a lot of potential with the women's side of this because there isn't a women's Canadian Premier League. They'd essentially be coming in first. And if you establish these teams in their markets and, you know, unfortunately, but truthfully, you don't require as much salaries to take your women's teams up further up, right? In terms of their context of where they'd stand. So you pay these, you know, an amateur semi-pro league in Canada, that would be unique. You would attract some really good players. They would instantly become a league that would garner more respect, honestly, in general media, I think, because they would be viewed as the top women's league in the country. We don't have a Voyageurs Cup for the women right now. Maybe you create that through this. We don't have a championship women's club team other than on the amateur level, through the club common championships that happen through the CSA. That's the only women's championship we have. This would offer a professional option for that, and I think that that's tremendously positive, and it would absolutely be something that all parties, I would hope, would look at and go, okay, well, this might be our pathway. You take, if you see the Campeonato, you look at this league that's happening, you take the Western teams there, you look at the League One Ontario teams that are already happening, I've covered that. I've worked for that league before, so I can tell you that the League One Ontario Women's Division is very high level. Those teams could jump in and be, with a little bit of support financially, could already be close to what they're talking about here. You take some of those teams and you suddenly create the best of the best and play that, like, it's going to be a compelling level that could potentially evolve into what the Canadian Premier League is talking about here without them necessarily doing directly attaching to the teams that exist within the CAMPL, which would be positive, because I don't think, the one thing I don't want to see when it comes to the women's division in the Canadian Premier League, well, take anything because we need it, but ideally you don't want it to be the women's Canadian Premier League, you know what I mean? With just right. Like Forge women, Cavalry women, because ultimately that sort of has a ghettoization to it. If you have this evolve separately, but then affiliate it, I think that would be your best solution.
And it's funny you say that, because I was just about to ask you that. If the women's teams would have to carry the same name and be in the same cities as these D2 teams. But you just answered it there. Maybe you can touch on it a bit more and expand. Could the Canadian Women's League reach the same level as the NWSL, considering just how much Canadian talent there is in the women's set?
NWSL is tough. The NWSL pays more salary than the CAMPL right now, considerably more salary than the CAMPL. So, you'd have to catch that first in terms of, salary equations. But I do think, yes, the Canadian Premier League for women could absolutely become one of the best leagues in the world for women, especially outside of Europe. I think you could maybe have it comparable to the W League in Australia in very quick order, which the Australian model, we always like to compare ourselves to the Americans, but realistically, our entire system, Australia is where you should be looking at. That's what they should aspire to. It has a very similar history, a very similar sort of culture, sporting culture in the two countries. Different sports, but similar in the sense that they're unique and isolated. So I think that if you look at the W League, that might be what you could get this to. And the W League is a well-respected league in the world of women's professional soccer, and if a Canadian league could one day get there, then absolutely. And also, the W League is propelling the Australian women into a legitimate World Cup contender, unlike the faux World Cup contending that we like to claim the Canadian women are at.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens and what kind of impact it has on the Canadian women's national team. Dwayne, I want to thank you so much again for making time. Peter and I appreciate it, as well as our listeners. You can find Dwayne on Twitter at 24th Minute. He co-hosts Soccer Today with Kevin Laramie on Sports Podcast Network every Monday and Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. His website is 24thminute.substack.com.
Having mentioned Toronto FC, the MLS is around the corner. Lots has transpired this offseason, and we didn't really get a chance to discuss a lot of MLS on our first episode, something that we wanted to do in our second. Obviously, shining the news of Thierry Henry. But, let's dive a little deeper into all three clubs,
yes,
if we can. We'll start with TFC, seeing that we just talked about them. Chris Armas replacing Greg Vanney. What do you make of the move?
I think, considering you were hearing rumblings about Greg Vanney, the contract is pretty much signed, he just has to actually put his name on the dotted line and the contract's all sorted, and then you just didn't really hear anything about it for a couple of months after that, that kind of indicated something was up, right? And then obviously with the ongoing situation with the pandemic, he's separated from his family. There were rumors that he wasn't given a little bit more control with certain sporting aspects, right? All of this, I think, went into the eventual departure of Greg Vanney. And then obviously the LA Galaxy job being available, I'm sure, just kind of amplified that a little bit more. And then obviously ended up at the LA Galaxy to no one's surprise. So that part of it. I suppose in the end, I wasn't surprised, but I guess if you were to have asked me a couple of months before that, is Greg Vandy going to leave? I would have said definitely not. Chris Armas is someone who, yes, he was an assistant while Ali Curtis was at the New York Red Bulls, but they know each other. They work together. And in terms of Armas coming, I know to fans, it sounds like an underwhelming hire, and I kind of get why. TFC's reputation has significantly improved the last 5 or 6 years. But again, you have to remember, it is a pandemic. You're going to be living in Florida for the season. It's tough to get candidates in who are going to be okay with that, right? And that's, again, partially why Vanny and also Thierry Henry, as you mentioned, Thomas, left in the end, or at least part of the reason why he left. Armas himself has drawn criticisms for losing some marquee games with the Red Bulls, and I totally get that. There was the infamous collapse against Atlanta in the 2018, what was it, Eastern Conference Final, and then the loss to Philadelphia in the first round of the playoffs the next year. But that's literally 2 games worth of a sample size in a playoff format where, as we know, a lot of random variables can contribute to certain results playing out the way they were. Look at Toronto FC's victory over Atlanta in 2019 in the conference final, right? Like, Atlanta heavily outchanced Toronto, but 2 goals out of nowhere gave Toronto the win, right? But I think on the flip side, if you were to look at this positively, this is still a man who, yes, he did take over for Jesse Marsh midseason in 2018. They won the Supporters' Shield over that Atlanta United MLS Cup winning team. And they did so with the 5th lowest payroll in the league that year. They spent about $7.8 million. The next year, spending went up to $8.6 million, but they were the 3rd lowest spending team in the league. Yet despite that, I think Armas has shown an ability to keep the consistency going with a squad that's given to him. And I think if you are a TFC fan, you know, and you look at Armas as a stopgap solution for a couple of years, I think this is perfectly fine. And then you also have to remember the Red Bulls didn't address some big areas of the club, strikers especially, once Bradley Wright Phillips got hurt. We know MLSE spent the most in the league for the last several years now, so Armas will have more resources. He's promoted youth at the Red Bulls, one of the best academies in the league. TFC has the talent coming through the academy, but they haven't gotten many chances. You imagine now they're going to get that, because Ali Curtis has spoken a lot about wanting to give academy kids a shot, and they did, in fairness, in 2020, but maybe not regularly enough. And then interestingly, Thomas, if you look at the Red Bulls' expected goals in 2018 and 19, they were either identical or better than TFC's numbers. And yet he was spending basically 66% less in salary, or the club was spending 66% less in salary than Toronto. So you can look at this either glass half full or glass half empty. I feel like as a temporary solution for the next couple of years, Armas is more than a decent enough hire. What would you think?
I think it's a hire that makes sense. At the end of the day, you want a coach who has MLS experience and who will do well in MLS. Various foreign coaches have come to the MLS and not succeeded. Whatever reason, who knows? I think every scenario is individual in that sense. But you know, it's funny. I was actually at the conference, at the press conference on Zoom, when Greg Vanny, you know, said his goodbyes to everyone, essentially saying that it was family, and he felt that a cycle at Toronto FC was done. Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't. It didn't feel almost that. It felt almost like this Toronto FC had sort of finished a cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of speak, like they almost needed, you know, something, you know, to really change them. And at the end of the day, Greg Vanny, you know, he had spent a various amount of time away from home. And it's funny, he was actually asked about the LA Galaxy links. And, you know, obviously he respectfully denied any sort of link to LA Galaxy, which, you know, he was, I think, named a month later. But, you know, Chris Armas, you were saying, I was actually going to say it already, but he is, you know, Ali Curtis' man. And, you know, winning the Supporters' Shield is massive. It's not like, it's not a participation award per se. You know, you're the best MLS club in the regular season. That's something to be proud of. After, of course, Jesse Marsh left to be head coach of Red Bull. But look, at the end of the day, I think TFC needs something more than just Chris Armas. It's good that, you know, he's been fond of youth, because TFC has sort of been criticized for not playing enough youth, especially a lot of their homegrown youth academy signings haven't really panned out. Not panned out, but, well, a lot of them don't pan out, right? At the end of the day, yeah, not everyone gets promoted. But the ones that do get, yeah, exactly. But the ones that do get promoted to the first team don't get played, yeah, or don't get played enough.
Yeah.
So I think I like that signing in that regard, that he is going to be more open to playing youth. I like that, especially because it helps the Canadian national team. But yeah, I mean, I think I remember when Patrick Vieira was linked to Toronto FC, or the old PSG coach, and then you saw that he signed in Qatar.
Yeah, Laurent Blanc.
Exactly. So you didn't really know how many guys they had in the carpet per se, in a folder, how many names that we could really gone to. But it's good that he already has an existing relationship with the management, and like you say, if he can already do so much with as much as payroll, Toronto FC is a team that has more money because obviously they are backed by MLSE. So if they have more money to sign than they did of the New York Red Bulls, it's certainly going to give him more resources. And like you said, you know, we might see Borre in a TFC kit.
Yes,
that saga continues for now.
Well, yeah, and this is what transitions us nicely here, because I feel like Chris Armas coming in, Thomas, and I'm sure you'll agree with me because you were there for his unveiling. They're going to be playing a high pressing system, right? And if they're going to be doing this, they're probably going to need another striker. That's why you've been seeing links to Ioaki Nola maybe being shipped away, because there's interest from abroad. There's also interest in Jozy Altidore, although he's kind of shot down those rumors. Someone's kind of wondering, will he actually go or will he stay? He's obviously on a very big ticket. But the talk involving Rafael Santos Borre is still very, very hot right now, right? He's, despite the fact that he did reject Palmeiras and Palmeiras was doing everything possible to try and sign him, they were even willing to pay River Plate a certain fee to get him out of his contract early, so essentially get him right away, and then, hey, here's some money for your troubles, and we'll take him off your hands, and then that's that. Borre rejected them.
And not forget that TFC outbid Palmeiras.
That as well, yes. And again, they offered a 3-year contract worth $5 million a year. That's according to the recent reports. That's what TFC offered Borre. But do you think that move actually gets across the line? Or do you think TFC may prioritize an under-22 initiative signing given that new rule from the recently revised CBA?
Well, before I dive into this, let me say one thing in Spanish. En Argentina, las cosas se mueven muy lentas. English translation is, in Argentina, things happen slowly. Mm-hmm. And that's true. Yeah. You know, in Argentina, we've known there's no short of scandals yes. In Argentina football. Things move slowly there.
Yep.
But obviously, money talks at the end of the day. Money talks at the end of the day. And the latest report I actually saw was that Borre is actually considering Europe.
Yes.
Hence, he wants to. The reason for Europe is because he wants to be called up into the Colombian national team more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, if Borre wants to be part of the Colombian national team, I'm sure he's going to have to consult with his inner group and ask himself, will the Colombian FA consider me if I'm banging in 15, 20, 25 goals in MLS, or do they actually need me to be playing in Holland, in Portugal, yeah, in the top five?
Yeah.
I think that's something he wants to consider, because at the end of the day, if he wants to be a national team player and he finds out that Rueda and everyone else in the Colombian FA doesn't rate the MLS as high, because right now I haven't seen any MLS players, any Colombian MLS players in the Colombian national team. So that's something he wants to consider, I'm sure. There's some players from Mexico, though, Liga MX. So, you know, I'm sure he wants to do that. But again, very interesting to see that the Toronto FC has the money, backed by MLSE, of course, and they can outbid someone like Palmeiras. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
But it put out a poll asking fans if TFC really need Borre. 64% of them said yes. 36% of them said no. I guess it really depends how far TFC are willing to go. Right now, are they a playoff side? Sure. But are they a contending side? No, they're not. On paper, at least.
Yeah.
I think if they added a guy like Borre, you could add significant wins
to your
2020 standings.
Yeah. A lot of people who watch him get frustrated because he misses a lot of easy chances, which is true. He does. But Here's the thing, Thomas, and I'm sure you'll agree with me. I like strikers who regularly pop up in quality positions. And the fact of the matter is, you're not going to finish 100% of the chances you take. So if you are getting in position to take 7, 8, 9 shots a game, or like quality shots a game, not all of them are going to go in for you, right? But all you need is one in a lot of cases, right? And Borre has shown a regular ability to be able to do that. And yes, it's true, Jozy Altidore and Io Akinola can finish very, very well. They're quite intelligent off the ball as well. They make some very, very good runs, especially Akinola for a player his age. But the problem is, and this is why Toronto FC is going to be looking at a striker like Borre, he presses, whereas Akinola and Altidore, not that involved in the pressing game. Now, could they be if Armas wanted them to? I'm sure Akinola could. Altidore remains to be seen. But if you look at every other category besides, you know, scoring and shots and all that, Borre has the advantage in turnovers. He had a better turnover rate, in other words, didn't turn over the ball as much. Better dribbling success, more pressing, better pressure regains, better pretty much everything across the board. So if you land a guy like Borre, then that's your dream signing if you're Chris Armas and Ali Curtis. So we'll have to see what happens in that regard, but I mean, if they can pull it off, kudos to them, but I agree with you. I think that if I'm Borre and you're seeing guys like, obviously, Duván Zapata and Luis Muriel and strikers of that caliber banging in goals in Serie A and getting regular call-ups and starts for the national team, that's probably going to have to be your path to get into consideration, as opposed to, you know, going to MLS, which is the sad reality, but it is what it is, right? If you look at the rest of the squad, Thomas, there have been no other major signings yet, other than retaining Justin Morrow and Eric Zavaleta. Is there any other glaring weakness in this squad for you as we approach the season here?
I would say they have to reinforce the defense. I think the defense is a bit aging.
I agree.
I think if they could get a young center back or a young fullback to really put pressure, I think that would be really, really good. If they could sign a young, maybe a guy from college or you know, a player who really shined in USL, so they could maybe get him cheap. No major signings have happened. But considering that recently Pablo Piatti has left Toronto FC,
right,
announcing it via his Instagram page, then being confirmed by Elche in Spain. Interesting signing. No, nothing against Pablo Piatti, but I just don't know if he has the quality to be playing in Spain. You know, it sort of reminds me of, you know, a similar situation. Yeah, it sort of reminds you of Adrián Aquete, him coming from Segunda División. But again, which league is really higher, MLS or Segunda División in Spain? I would say MLS is a bit more, just because the financial situation in Spain is very critical. And Spain has been in economic downfall the last 15, 20 years. And, you know, MLS, very similar teams can just afford so many players, can sign DPs on $5-6 million, making more of the entire team altogether.
Yeah, exactly. I'm with you on all of that, especially the defense. I feel like the Zavaleta signing kind of indicates, all right, we want to add one more player with experience. The problem is, ability-wise, I don't know if he's exactly the quickest, and this kind of goes back to their big issue. Outside of Chris Mavinga, no one else on that backline is particularly quick. Omar Gonzalez is very good when the game is in front of him, but if you're asking him to defend on the run in a high line, he can get exploited very easily. But this could be an opportunity for someone like, I don't know, for example, Julian Dunn, right? Had a very good stint at Valor at the Island Games. Like, someone like that could come in, partner Mavinga from time to time, and prove that he deserves a spot. And then you have Rocco Romeo in Denmark in the second division with Hugo, who's killing it right now. He could be another option when he comes back. I believe he'd be back in May or June, who could start pushing for a spot. So there are certainly options there. We'll just see if Armas actually gives them a shot, as well as the other Canadian youngsters that they have. Let's go over to the Whitecaps, Thomas. This is a very difficult team to pin down sometimes, as we all know. And, you know, they were the only Canadian club to miss the playoffs last year. We saw improvements after the Canadian series of the regular season once everyone in the squad was fully fit and or available for the first time. They actually put together a very nice run at the end of the year and nearly got into the playoffs. Actually got more points than the Montreal Impact, but they were in different conferences, and that's what led to them getting knocked out. They've signed David Caicedo. Bruno Gaspar is supposedly joining. They're also closing in on Caio Alexandre, a young Brazilian midfielder, which I find intriguing as well. Still no number 10 signed, despite promises from the club, Axel Schuster specifically, that that's going to happen. Thomas, I know Vancouver is difficult to predict in terms of what's going to happen with them, but what is your outlook for them this season based on what they've done?
Well, we just saw Freddie Montero join the Seattle Sounders, you know, right. Basically his home, a city that, you know, he considers his home. I definitely do think they need more, especially in the midfield. Nothing against, you know, the youth signings that they have. Obviously, Russell Tybert is pretty much is a poster boy. He's pretty much the franchise player for the Mannix Canadian. But I don't know if the other youth Canadians can really play a full 20, 25, 30 game season. And I don't know. I think I would say, you know, it's a good thing to have Maxime Crépeau back there. And you know how Bruno Gaspar is going to impact things. I think that's going to be good. But you mentioned earlier, Ali Adnan. How much is that guy making a year salary-wise? And just how much are they really getting out of him? I think that's an interesting point to take forward. And I have to say, hot take here, this is Mark Dos Santos' last year to prove himself, mm-hmm. I think, at the Whitecaps. If Dos Santos doesn't do good this year, I think they're going to give him the boot and go for another coach.
Well, that would have been actually something I was going to ask you. Basically, if the season didn't start well, would Mark Dos Santos' job be at risk? And I'd have to say I agree with you, because he kind of saved himself at the end of last season, right? Based on the results that they got, the late push in the regular season, once everybody was fit, they put together a couple of decent results against some strong teams. But look, let's be honest. If they start the season poorly again, maybe the pandemic saves him, just because it would be tough to bring in a candidate and, you know, let's relocate again to the U.S. for another year. Kind of goes back to the whole, you know, TFC and Montreal issue. That might be the one thing that saves him. But if they start out slowly, the pressure is going to be on. That's for sure. I will slightly disagree with you when it comes to the midfield, Thomas, because Michael Baldissimo is someone who I think is ready to break through. Now, I think the Caio Alexandre signing kind of puts a wrinkle into this, because Alexandre is someone who, if you just look at the underlying numbers themselves, he is a player who pretty much two things stick out right away. Very involved in the team's buildup, covers a lot of ground, and likes to progress the ball deep into the final third. Now, that's a lot of what Michael Baldissimo does. Is it possible that they maybe are going to miss out on a DP number 10 signing now, and they're just going to sign Alexandre, who I believe would actually meet this U22 initiative rule? Sign him now, basically give Baldissimo and Owusu and Bekele, or whoever happens to start there, some extra support in possession to essentially alleviate some of that burden until that DP number 10 comes. And that, to me, is probably very likely to happen. But even if the DP number 10 doesn't come in, and I understand Whitecaps fans are going to be a little bit upset that it doesn't happen, but I feel like the Whitecaps will be able to cope without that signing. And hear me out. If they sign Alexandre, that's another player who can progress the ball forward. You have David Caicedo, who's going to partner Ali Adnan on the left flank. So finally, there's a little bit of support for Adnan going forward. And Caicedo's someone who likes to drift inside a lot, who's a goal threat and a creative threat, as is Christian Dahomé on the other side. He's going to have Bruno Gaspar with him. You would imagine if that signing gets over the line. Gaspar is someone who's very involved in the team's buildup as well, when you look at his expected goals buildup numbers from Olympiacos and Sporting. So I feel like there's a lot there to like when it comes to the team going forward, because that's always been the issue. And in turn, that should help Lucas Cavallini, who had an unlucky start when it came to his finishing, but ended the campaign
well. Strong.
Very, very, very strong. 0.4 non-penalty expected goals per 90 minutes, which is quite solid given how poor the Whitecaps were attacking. So add in those names, you feel like that's going to improve Cavallini as well. My one concern with the team, though, is the back line and how it's going to be deployed. Because outside of Eric Godoy and maybe Derek Cornelius, if he gets a consistent run of games and not just randomly taken out of the 11 on a whim, that's the only center back who I feel can play in a high line. Veselinovic and Rose have been exploited time and time again in a high line. So that's why I feel it may not hurt to add another center back into the fold, whether it's a Gianfranco Facchinari, who can play on the left, even though he's right-footed, as well as on the right side. I don't know, but I feel like you may have to incorporate someone else who's going to be comfortable in that situation, especially if Dos Santos wants to press from the front and be a little bit more aggressive with the signings that he makes.
Again, I'm not sure just how much money the Whitecaps have really available to them. When they teased the Cavallini signing, we know how much, you know, the Whitecaps social media team, you know, put out this video of people saying, spend money, spend money. You know, finally they spend money with right. the Cavallini signing him from Puebla and Liga MX, which he did very, very well in. But like you say, the back line, they do need reinforcements for sure. Cornelius has shown well. That's why he's at times been Canada's number one center back. But I think they need to go out and get someone from a top league. Nothing against, you know, an NCAA signing per se, but you just don't know what you're gonna get. Someone like Chaced Kimri, who came from Tunisia. He's young, but you know, realistically, is it really gonna have an effect on your guys when you're playing against some very, very, very strong forwards in the Western Conference?
That is true. The only obstacle I could potentially see in that is I don't think the Whitecaps have any more international slots after they sign Alexandra, which could put them at a disadvantage. Now, they could acquire an international slot from someone if they really wanted to and address that, but that is probably going to have to be an area that they'll have to look at. But also kudos to the Whitecaps, too, because they filled out soccer operations. They've hired Nikos Overhull. They hired Kevin Antunes, as well as a couple of others. It's a long time coming, but this should really help with their recruitment and alleviate some of the pressure on guys like Axel Schuster. But yeah, a few years too late, but it's finally happened. We'll see if that kind of turns it around. It looks like it kind of has, because it looks like they're signing players that are actually going to make a difference in areas of need, which is kind of something they haven't addressed the last few years, which is so shocking to say, but it has happened. Thomas, before we move on, is there anything you want to say about the Montreal Impact? I know we talked about them on episode one, and we kind of got our thoughts out in that episode, but is there anything else you want to say that we didn't discuss last week?
About Montreal, I would say it's interesting because Montreal, for me, I feel like they're, you know, they made the playoffs last year, and, you know, they showed great flair in parts of the year. But to me, I think Montreal, their goalkeeping, for me, is an interesting part. Just how much will that be able to hold up throughout the year? And really, who comes in? I haven't seen any new reports of any head coach signing. Maybe they get Laurent Simon, although that would be the quickest player to coach transition ever.
That's true. Maybe Wilfred Nancy gets appointed full time. I know he's kind of been leading things a little bit, but yeah, it's going to be tough to get a candidate in there, that's for sure. We'll move over to the CPL. A lot of big news happening the last 6 or 7 days here across the board. It started with Stephen Hart signing a 3-year extension with HFX Wanderers. This is just a few months after he guided the team from one of the worst clubs in 2019 to the Island Games final, losing, of course, to Forge. Your thoughts on Hart staying in Halifax, Thomas? Is this a no-brainer?
Yeah, it's a no-brainer. I mean, he brought a team that finished last in the inaugural year and brought them all the way to the CPL final. So that's a massive improvement, considering that, you know, they have a lesser budget than all other markets. I think it's no surprise there. But yeah, no, it's good for him. You know, he's also a guy that who is not someone like you have to force, not force, but you don't have to demand or ask from someone to come in from a different city or different country. Hart already lives in Halifax, so I'm sure if he wasn't coaching this team, I don't know what else he would be doing. So I mean, it's sort of like he had to be involved in some way, shape, of any capacity, really. Yeah. So that's my thoughts on Hart. I think you know, he's a guy that fits the profile, and he's someone who's probably going to be in the league for a long time to come.
Clearly a no-brainer to re-sign him. He's done very, very well given the more limited player pool in the Maritimes, right? He's done well in recruiting U Sports prospects, Peter Schala being chief among them. But bringing in someone like, you know, like Bent, filling out the back line with guys like Jake Ruby and other players who've impressed, even some of the PLSQ signings he's made, Krisnovic Ensa, Abubakar Sissoko, these guys have made, well, did make before they left, an incredible impact with the team in such a short amount of time. And his eye for talent has really helped them in a way overachieve, but he's also set them up to succeed with selective pressing, which triggered some mistakes for some very timely goals from Akeem Garcia. Then they defended in very disciplined blocks, right? Because he understands that Jeff Farrar and Schala, not the quickest center backs. So if we keep everything in front of them, I dare you to score. And if they somehow get past us, Oxner is going to make a crucial save. And it worked up until the final. But even in that final, they were frustrating Forge a lot. So, I mean, very much deserved for him. But that... The news didn't stop there, Thomas, because Tristan Borges has returned to Forge from Leuven on loan. He hasn't played a competitive match in more than a year, so clearly this move was needed from Borges' point of view. But a couple people were talking about this. Is this a step back for Borges at this point in his career, or do you think that this is just simply something he has to do to get his career back on track?
No, it's not a step down, considering you just made the point that he hasn't played a competitive match in over a year. This is something he has to do. All players in similar situations or other situations have at one point found themselves sort of lingering and, you know, not in the manager's or club's plans and, you know, been benched, pushed aside or whatnot. This move makes sense. It's a chance for him to get his confidence back, to get his playing back, a lot of minutes, to again shine in the CPL. But if he's a guy that, for me personally, he has the talent to play in Europe, you know, maybe next time he gets loaned out to a league like Denmark. I think Belgium might have been a step up too high for him.
But look, this is not a step down for him at all right now. He's going to be 23 by season's end, still more than enough time to get back on track and then maybe return to Europe or move to another club outside the CPL and restart from there. A one-year divergence doesn't really change that. He knows Forge. He understands the system well. So you know he'll integrate right away, right? All this is very obvious. But from Forge's point of view, Thomas, how big of a boost is this for them, given, I wouldn't say they were necessarily lacking on attacking depth, but this certainly gives them some depth and quality, no?
Oh, yeah, 100%. This is definitely good for them. And I would be shocked if Borges doesn't come in and be their number two or number two option. Number one or number two option, excuse me.
I just feel like, really, for both parties, this made a lot of sense. And last year at the Island Games, Forge's open play expected goals was mid-table. They were kind of lacking behind the likes of Pacific. I think Cavalry had better performances in that regard. So he'll help add some improvisation and maybe take a little bit of the attacking burden off certain guys. Closing it out, Marcel de Jong. He has retired, which is maybe not too surprising given that he pretty much started his CPL career with a devastating injury. But he's going to be known for a lot of reasons. He's obviously been capped more than 50 times for Canada, had stints in the Bundesliga, the Eredivisie. He most recently helped start the CPL Players Union, which just got FIFA Pro membership, which we talked about last week. But Thomas, how are you going to remember Marcel de Jong, someone who we can say is a national team veteran?
Yeah, he had a very good career, not only in Eredivisie, in his home country of Holland, but also in the Bundesliga. To maintain yourself in the Bundesliga for as many years as he did, very impressive. I respect his career very much. Unfortunate timing that, you know, in all the years that he represented Canada, collectively, he didn't find success. You know, the defense was shaky at times, but, you know, he's one guy that to me stand out that no matter if he had a good day or a bad day, and more times than not, he had a good shift for the national team.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. So here to Marcel de Jong, an amazing career. And, you know, let's see, maybe he'll stick around in some capacity with the CPL. The Canadian Olympic squad, Thomas, you kind of touched on it to start the show. There've been I wouldn't even really call them leaks. I'd just say club announcements revealing who is going to be joining the Canadian squad in Mexico. Because there has been no official squad released yet, but we know at least three players are going to be there. That is Matthew Nogueira from Marítimo. He is a goalkeeper, 22 years old. Lucas Dias, another Portuguese-based player, talked about him last week, attacking midfielder for Sporting's under-23s. And Zorian Bassong, Montreal defender, who just actually signed there this offseason, revealed that he's going to be going for Olympic qualifying, as well as some other Montreal Impact players. And Mark Dos Santos, too, saying that they'd make pretty much all Whitecaps players available for the respective national teams. But Thomas, your thoughts on these three call-ups specifically, and then maybe the news that it looks like Mauro Biello is going to have most of his pick of the MLS teams.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm a big fan of Bassong. Having watched him play, I think he's, you know, in France, especially, you know, a club of that size that he was at in Lille, you know, Belgium wanted him at some point in his youth career. Convincingly enough, Canada gets him. For Matthew Nogueira as a goalkeeper, I think he would probably be slotted in. I would have to guess, at least. This is no info. But I guess he would have to be the third string after Dane Sinclair and James Pantemis. I would be surprised if Mauro Biello has him slotted in as first.
Yeah, probably. But, you know, decent experience for him. He is also match fit, which I think we should consider, too. He's been playing for the under-23s, which is very, very important to consider when Canada's trying to get into those Olympic qualifiers. But, yeah, I agree with you. Bassong will be a nice addition. Very solid fullback, for sure. Very good two-way fullback. A good signing for Montreal as well. And then I made my thoughts on Lucas Dias known last week, so I don't really have to repeat myself. But I'm very excited to see him with the under-23s, for sure. And that kind of boosts future hopes of him playing for the senior national team, potentially, in the future. But we shall see. Just a reminder, though, Olympic qualifying for Canada starts March 19th. That's against El Salvador in Guadalajara. Then they play March 22nd against Haiti. And then the final game of the group stage is March 25th against Honduras. Top two from each group advance to the semifinals. Winners of those semifinals qualify for the Tokyo Games. Canada would likely have to play, though, one of the U.S. and Mexico in order to get to those Olympics. So it is a bit of a tall task, but if everybody is available, maybe that improves their chances a little bit. Thomas, we'll close out with Canadians abroad, specifically Jonathan David, because he had quite a week for himself. He hadn't scored in six straight games until this week, completing a late double to help Lille stay top of Liga versus Marseille. Then he kind of scored off the bench against Ajaccio in the French Cup, although I feel like that goal being ruled as an own goal was a bit of a cop-out. David definitely scored that on his own. It was probably going to go in regardless. But that's now 9 goals in 28 games in the league, and that's 10 in all competitions. He's also tied for 5th in non-penalty goals in Liga, and when you consider he only scored once in his first 13 games, and has now scored, I believe it's now 9 in the preceding 13. That's a very solid ratio, but your thoughts on his productive week and his productive 2021 as a whole?
Yeah, I'm very impressed with Jonathan David. I think moving to France was the right move. You know, when he was linked with Premier League sides, I thought maybe that would have been too big of a jump. But League One is definitely a good choice for him and his agent, per se. He's definitely shined with Lille, scoring 2 goals against a Marseille side that has a lot of, you know, French national team players. So I'm sure there were a lot of eyes there for sure. One of the things I wanted to ask you is that I'm curious to hear what you think is, after this season, do you think Jonathan David is ready to move not sideways to Serie A, but maybe try his luck in Spain or Germany or even in England?
No, I think he should stay. I think he should stay for another year. I think we've seen with a lot of players going from Belgium to Liga, it's a very big adjustment. And I think him being there and now settling in and kind of becoming the man now in a way is going to help him a lot more than if he were to move now. I mean, Lille are in a little bit of a financial pickle right now. You know, they are in a lot of debt, so you know, if an offer comes in, they may have to accept it. But I think if it was David's choice, he should stay 110%. But it's interesting, though, Thomas, because that Marseille game, he was probably going to be substituted out with about 20 minutes to go. Christophe Galtier, the coach of Lille, even admitted this after that game. He actually said that he found his first, and I'm quoting him directly here, "I found his first half difficult in terms of the quality of his sequences, his movements, and then when I saw that Marseille were installing a really deep block in the final 20 minutes, I took note of what my bench was saying, that he could unblock the situation, and he was very opportunistic." And that is kind of an understatement. But if you watch the last 20 minutes, you see David doing what he likes to do. He's dropping deep, dragging defenders out of position, finding gaps between the defense on counterattacks. This allowed Jonathan Bamba, Luis Araujo to burst into those open spaces carved up by David. The first goal was a very good example of this, as well as the second goal. David was occupied by two defenders on the first goal. It gives Araujo time and space to receive and pass to Ikone, who got slightly more time to shoot because of the fact that David opened up that space. And then the rebound fell to David for him to put away. And then the second goal, he runs from the left into the center between Chaleta Char and Balerdi as Bamba pounced on a loose ball. And then Chaleta Char and Balerdi have no idea what's going on. They have to run back into position on a counterattack. Bamba plays in the first time ball into David, and then he eventually finishes it off. So it was just a really good summation of what I think David excels in, and just that if you give him the chances, he's going to put them away. And it's nice to see that he is now finally meeting his expected goals, because he was underachieving in that regard a lot in the first half of the season. It's now coming back to normal, which is, from a Canadian national team perspective, very, very good to see.
I guess just to answer my own question there, I would love to see, I wouldn't mind at all if Jonathan David stayed with Lille, not just for a couple of more seasons, but all of his career. Rarely ever do you see a Canadian making it to a top five league. And if he's comfortable there, I don't see why you have to make a move, unless obviously Lille receive a substantial amount of money being thrown their way. Other Canadians in action, Scott Arfield, yes, winning the league with Rangers. We've seen, you know, the domination of Celtic various years. Rangers finally win with him. Hopefully Scott Arfield is back with Canada. I remember an interview that Steven Gerrard made saying that he's not going, I say, quote, "Arfield is not going to play for Canada anymore. Isn't on international duty anymore. That's a good thing," end quote. That's what Steven Gerrard was saying. A lot of fans freaked out saying, has he retired? Has he left the national team? I'm sure he was just referring to the fact that Canada hadn't played a competitive game in, what, 6-8 months,
yeah,
or something,
exactly,
like that. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's what he was referring to.
Yeah.
But yeah, Arfield winning with Rangers, really good move for him.
Absolutely. I mean, it was kind of expected after Celtic kind of just tripped over themselves for most of the year, but Rangers were sensational throughout. I mean, they could actually match that invincible season that Celtic did a few years back in their first season under Brendan Rodgers, so that could be something. But yeah, the Arfield situation is interesting, because if you hear both sides of it, you know, John Herdman's willing to bring him back. Scott Arfield is kind of indicating, like, hey, listen, it's all up to Herdman. There doesn't seem to be a problem there, I don't think. But look, he's the captain, right? Whenever he's available, not having the captain around could be a little bit of an issue. And he's also a useful player. So we'll see if that gets resolved. Maybe not in the next month or two, but certainly at some point this year, you imagine Arfield's back in the fold. Also worth mentioning, Kyle Larin getting an assist in Besiktas' most recent game. They're fighting for the title there. So that's very good to see. Anything else you want to talk about, Thomas, before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I just want to say that for me, Arfield, that you just touched on it there, I think he's our number one midfielder, with the exception of Atiba Hutchinson, who I think is time to move on in the future. Some fans want to fight me on that. It's okay. But Scott Arfield, I think he's our number one midfielder. And Kyle Larin has done so well with Besiktas that, to me, he should be in the starting 11.
You won't get any disagreements from me here, whether that's on this show, Thomas, or on Twitter or any other platform. Speaking of which, you can follow us, the show, at Northern Football on Twitter. You can follow myself, Peter Galindo, at GalindoPW. You can follow Thomas Neff, at Thomas Neff, on Twitter. And if you listen to your podcasts on Apple, please leave us a review. It does help boost the profile of the show, and it is greatly appreciated. Even if you have some criticisms that you maybe want us to address as well, that's a good way to do it in the review. So please do that if you have the time. So for Thomas Neff, I am Peter Galindo. We are signing off.